This is Shinamaya and welcome to the new Common Sense. This year my favourite author was Charles Eisenstein, author of the book The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible. Recently I had a wonderful opportunity to catch up with him. I hope you enjoy the interview. You're the author of six books that I know of, but the one that really turned me on to you was given to me by a dear friend, The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible. And having read that book and then most of your others, it seems to me that Hearts is a real work of love, the flow of love. Don't get me wrong, I really enjoyed all of your writing, but that one feels to me where your heart is. Am I right? And could you explain to the listener the gist of The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible?
I would say that I put a lot of heart into all the books, but I think you're definitely picking up on something where the two previous books had a lot more research, and I think I was maybe trying to legitimize myself a little bit by demonstrating, oh, see, I can do research, I'm smart, I'm educated, so it's okay to believe me. And in The More Beautiful World, I had more confidence by that time, but I didn't try to do that as much, and I just kind of poured my heart out onto the page.
Well, it has a pace to it that, to me, could only come from the passion of an author revealing truth rather than an intellectual, assembly. For me, sometimes truth feels like an aggregate of a lot of others, but in a lot of your work, there are leaps that defy construction as though you were reaching into profoundly new areas. Does that feel true to you, and is that the sort of creativity that drives you? Is that something you strive for?
My experience is of connecting to a field of information that is already present. It's like the book is already there. And I don't know if that answers your question.
Absolutely. Absolutely it does. And is that something you strive for then? Is that like a meditation almost? So it sounds to me as though you are connecting to something much deeper than yourself.
Yeah, it's like I have... it's more than a curiosity. It's like a question, an obsession that won't let me alone. And I just carry it all the time. And then I'll be thinking about it, or I won't be thinking about it. I'll be, taking a walk or doing something else. And this new piece will appear, this connection that stops me in my tracks, maybe, or this, it's not really so much a download as a revelation. Like all of a sudden, something that was right in front of my face becomes visible. There it is. And then the work then is to translate that into words. But I do feel like the material comes as a gift, not something of my own construction, as you said, which is one reason why I don't really believe in intellectual property, because I think all, not to say that this is a work of genius, but I believe that all works of genius do come from a source beyond ourselves, and we're kind of the antenna or the scribes of them. Not that it's random. It is, I think, our questioning and our search that invites these things to find us. But in a sense, we don't do the finding.
That's gorgeous. And to me, I just wonder, you said, those moments of genius, are they as simple as moments of creativity, or are they those real leaps that you're talking about?
I'm just using the word loosely. For me, it's anything that I get the feeling that I couldn't do that.
Yes.
There it is. Yeah.
That's beautiful. One of my favorite ideas from Hearts is the concept of human innocence, that if we were to consider the stories of others as our own, we might find that we would act the same. Can you explain how that insight arrived for you, and perhaps explain a little bit about it to our listeners?
I don't remember how that insight arrived, but I've had a practice for a long time of trying to understand how people could do the things that are happening on this earth. And there's one theory is that they're just bad. These people are just bad.
Right.
Which that is a recipe for despair, because it seems that the people doing bad things are kind of in control of the world.
Right.
They're happening on a massive systemic level.
Yes.
So if it's just bad people, then the only solution is to overcome them with force, to be more powerful than they are. And that's not the situation on this earth right now. So that's a recipe for despair. There's another hypothesis about why people do bad things. It's because of the situation that they are in. And that felt a lot more true to me, because I myself have done, atrocious acts in my life, but I've done some things that I'm certainly not proud of. And when I try to understand why I did those things, I come to a kind of a self-forgiveness, because it's like, oh, I was just scared, or, oh, I was just seeking connection. Oh, I was just lonely. That's why I did that.
Right.
I was feeling, and so then by extension, I try to go into the situation of what is it like to be, a pharmaceutical company executive doing this, that, and the other thing, or what is it like to be Donald Trump, or what is it like to be a white supremacist?
Right.
Or a violent person, what happened to that baby, that little boy who was a sweetums and curious and wanted to learn? What turned him into this monster? Like, how did that happen? And if we understand the circumstances, then there's hope to change the world without overcoming the bad guy.
Yeah. In the ascent of humanity you speak about, what I think of is as societal truth. That is a belief that begins with a lie that becomes a habit, then part of our society's identity that we defend to the death. And your wonderful example was the idea that humans are the only creatures that have come to believe that pain is good. You know, no pain, no gain. Can you explain to the listener a little of that?
Yeah, no pain, no gain is part of the war on nature.
Mm.
That gets turned inward. So it says that progress comes through the conquest and domination or transcendence of the natural world. And this has been kind of a guiding program of civilization for a long time, where progress means to move into the artificial realm, the constructed realm, and ultimately the digital realm. And someday we'll upload our consciousness onto computers, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Or it can have a spiritual interpretation, where progress means that you become less fleshly, less material, your vibration rises, and you no longer sully yourself with the affairs of the flesh.
Yeah.
Same ambition. So progress comes by working against biology, working against the flesh. So therefore, pleasure in that view is an obstacle to be overcome, and pain is good, because if you're doing something painful, then you're resisting nature and rising above it. That particular, and it's not to say that we should never do anything hard or scary and never make efforts, but to equate hard with good and pleasure with bad, that is part of the same story that guides our devastation of nature.
And it seems to me, after you spoke a little bit about it, those creative leaps, they're almost the opposite, aren't they? I mean, they would seem to be effortless rather than effortful.
That's right. Yeah. There might be a lot of effort before the leaps happen.
But right.
Yeah, and actually what I just said is one of those leaps, you know, that moment when I realized, whoa, that's the same thing.
Right.
It's the same pattern. You know, that's one of the ones that just stopped me in my tracks.
I bet it did, yeah.
Where did that come from? You know, it came from my angst, my questioning, like, what is going on here? And that the endless attempts to answer that question that were futile were kind of a prayer that brought the answer to me by grace.
That's gorgeous. One of the most inspiring aspects of your offering to the world is that it is all presented as a gift. You refer to something called the gift economy as a method of relieving us from the monetization of everything and the imprisoning paradigm of everything being valued financially. And one of my favorite quotes from Sacred Economics, one of your books, when everything is subject to money, then the scarcity of money makes everything scarce, including the basis of human life and happiness. And another one I'd just like to mention as well was, when what we offer is sacred to us, then the only honorable way to offer it is as a gift. No price can be high enough to reflect the sacredness of the infinite. Can you explain a little bit about the gift economy?
Yeah, that's a big topic.
Sorry.
maybe I can kind of start with intellectual property. So, these spontaneous realizations, they're not only the result of my own questioning and exploration and research that invite them, but it's a collective questioning also, where millions of people are asking the same questions, striving for the same thing. And then that collective psychic energy attracts the realization that comes to one person. But is it that one person who then deserves all the benefits of that invention or that composition or whatever? No, that person is the receiving antenna for the entire culture.
Right.
And so the benefits should not belong to that person alone. And that's related to what you were saying about the quote, about when the work is sacred to you. Probably a lot of listeners have had this feeling that, especially if you're an artist, a musician, or a healer, or something like that, on the one hand, you don't want to charge for that. You're not in it for the money. You want everybody to benefit.
Yeah.
You want to share as widely as possible. And any price that you set is too high.
That's right.
And at the same time, any price is too low.
Yeah, no price can be high enough to reflect the sacredness of the infinite.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Any price is too high. Any price is too low. So what do you do?
Yeah.
And the solution that I've been working with is you give it and don't specify what the return gift should be. So someone is free to give nothing or a little or a lot, depending on the value to them and depending on the level of gratitude that they feel. So I have like online courses and you choose the price. It could be zero, could be, $200. It could be whatever feels good and right and clear to you. And that's an example of gift economy. It's not necessarily about not using money, but it's about, it's a spirit of gift where you're not in control of the return gift. If it's a gift, then there's some kind of release of control. If I say I'm going to give you this $1,000 and you have to pay me back in 6 months at whatever rate of interest, and if you don't, then I'm going to sue you and an armed agent of the state is going to come and expropriate your property. That's not a gift.
Yeah.
A gift, it involves trust, and therefore it generates relationship because you're going to feel gratitude or an obligation to give something back to me or to give something to somebody else. And thereby social ties are created and maintained.
Is this a part of this, more beautiful world our hearts know is possible, where we're talking about a state of interbeing, where we're not in competition, I guess, with each other, but feeling that we are each other?
Yeah. Because when we're in gift relationships, like if you're in a real community, then it's not like in the money economy where we're all in competition and your misfortune might be good for me.
Right.
Your podcast or whatever, your radio show goes offline and now there's more audience for mine.
Right.
You don't get the job and now I can get it. You lose in the stock market and I'm the winner. In a gift economy or what we call a community, where everybody is giving to everybody else, then if something bad happens to you, then that's less contribution that you're going to be making. And I'm going to be poorer as well. Your misfortune is my misfortune. Your good fortune is my good fortune. Your talents and gifts enrich me too, because in a gift culture, if you have more than you need, you give it. You don't accumulate. So everybody is giving to everybody else. And so you don't have the feeling of separation as much. You have the feeling of, yeah, we're in this together. You're part of me. Gift economy is, I guess you could say, the economic dimension of interbeing. And I'm on a farm here. That's why you hear a rooster and everything. There's a little farm life happening in the background. Yeah.
It's fantastic. Maybe you can tell, if you don't mind, would you tell a little bit about the new story and as far as how the old story is beginning to fold away, and what you talk about in Hearts is this idea of a new story.
Yeah. So by a story in this context, I mean the deep narratives and mythologies and meanings and agreements that run society. So they answer the questions like the deep human questions, like who am I? What is a self? What's real? What's important? How do I live life? How do I be a man or a woman? What does a good life look like? And for humanity, where do we come from and where are we going? What's the nature of life? Those are the deep questions that were answered in Western civilization by basically, I call it the story of separation, saying that who you are is a separate self in a world of other, surrounded by competing other selves, in a world that is just a bunch of random forces and generic particles, masses, in which the qualities of self are in human beings alone. So okay, I'm not going to go too much into that story. I've got a dog here begging my attention. Look at this beautiful dog. Anyway, so from that story, I'll just give like one example of how it plays out, but you know, you can see how we live in a world of separation from nature, separation from community, separation from the body. And so that story plays out in all of our systems, manifesting, for example, as the technological program to dominate nature. Because if nature is just a bunch of random forces that don't care about you, that have no purpose or intelligence, then our well-being depends on mastering those forces, on insulating ourselves from those forces, or harnessing them to our purposes, and imposing some intelligence on this random chaos that isn't there on its own, because there's no intelligence in the world outside of ourselves, so we have to provide that and impose that, and that's the human ambition. That's to become the masters of nature. So that's what I would call the old story, and it said that life will get better and better by doing that, and we would live in a paradise of robot servants and, you know, magical medicines that cure disease and bubble cities and space colonies and so forth. We had this kind of techno-utopian vision, and that story is falling apart today.
Right.
It hasn't brought this awesome future that we were supposed to have when I was a kid, you know, by the impossibly futuristic year 2000. I mean, we were supposed to, you know, live in paradise already. And instead, in some ways, things are getting worse and worse. People, like suicide rates, depression rates, anxiety. I mean, the program is not working. The program, it's obviously falling apart.
Yes.
The conquest of disease, that never materialized. The perfectly engineered society, the none of it has happened. And so, and not to mention the ecological crisis. So the story is falling apart, and it's giving way to what I call the new story, or the new and ancient story of interbeing, that says who you are isn't a separate self. Who you are is the totality of your relationships. Who you are is a holographic mirror of all that is. Every person that you encounter is a mirror of something inside of you. Everything that happens in the world is happening to yourself. Every species that goes extinct means something in you dies as well. That's the story of interbeing.
Right.
And it says the whole world has qualities of self too, and everything in it is alive and in some sense conscious. That's a short version of the story of interbeing. And from that story, everything changes.
Yeah, I mean, my experience with nature would suggest that we're the only ones that egoically separate ourselves from into being, that with the evolution of the mind and ego, we're the first to divorce ourselves from each other by labeling and cataloguing everything. I feel like trees and nature are actually naturally connected and communicate in a different way. So I guess my question is, have you contemplated the God story? Why were dinosaurs here for millions of years? And what was the story then? Why did we develop egos and separation?
Yeah, the ascent of humanity went into some of those deeper questions, because for a long time it seemed like humans were nature's big mistake.
Right.
That, you know, we developed these egos, developed a separation, and from that, civilization, industry, and ecological destruction and everything that goes along with it. And it seemed that maybe the solution, maybe the Earth would be better off without us.
Right.
Maybe language, agriculture, domestication, industry, were, you know, digital technology, right? All of these were one mistake after another, deeper and deeper down this path of perdition.
Yeah.
But, you know, eventually I came to understand this entire journey of separation as part of a larger process, an evolutionary process that was pretty much inevitable. Civilization arose independently pretty much anywhere it could, more or less the same time around the world, by similar processes, things like social class, division of labor, money, slavery, patriarchy, war. They all arose independently, and literature too, and mathematics, and technology, science, like all these good and bad, they all arose everywhere as if they were inevitable. And if it's inevitable, I think, okay, this is part of a larger process. Where is it taking us, this journey of separation? It's taking us towards some kind of initiation where we reach its extreme, and then it gives birth to something on a higher level. And I called it reunion in that book, but that's only, I don't know, that kind of oversimplifies it. It's not just going back to where we were. It's integrating the entire journey of separation into the reunion. And now we're getting kind of abstract.
Well, you know, given that the Earth is, you know, 4.5 billion years old, and life in one form or another has been here for at least 2 billion, and dinosaurs roamed for at least 100 million years, and we're talking about humans that have been around for like 5 or 6 thousand years, and perhaps, and you know, in the last 100 or 200 years, this real acceleration has taken place. I'm trying to get a feel for, like, it feels like we as humans have been here for like the last line of the Encyclopedia of the Earth story, you know, and there's this whole book that we haven't even, you know, got a clue on, and it also seems to me that it's accelerating like crazy, you know, in the last little bit with, you know, the communication and all that sort of thing. So I'm wondering, what do you feel about what was the 4.5 billion other years about?
I don't know why it had to take so long. I don't know what the, I mean, most of that, three billion years of that was the bacterial world.
Right.
There was nothing alive but bacteria. I don't know what the bacteria were thinking and planning and what was going on there. Later, the Permian, the Carboniferous eras, you know, those, if you want to think in this way, you could say, oh, those were laying down the materials necessary, the materials necessary for civilization to arise. It's like, if you wanted to say, okay, what would it take for a planet to evolve a species like ourselves doing what we do? A lot of the last billion years would have been necessary to create the conditions, the topsoil, for example. I mean, we're not just talking fossil fuels. All that topsoil was necessary to develop civilization too. And a lot of that was developed by grasslands, which are pretty recent. You know, grasses didn't develop, halfway through the age of the dinosaurs? I don't know. It's not that long ago geologically speaking.
Right.
So, yeah, you might be able to construct a story in which it's all happened in order for what's happening now to happen.
And so is there a God in your view, a creator, or are we the creator?
I would say way of asking the question comes from the story of separation.
Okay, that sorry.
It's kind of our vocabulary. It's in our vocabulary. It's not, you know, like a mistake that you made. It's in the linguistic and conceptual vocabulary that we swim in, because we can't easily comprehend that intelligence, purpose, an evolutionary direction is an intrinsic property of matter. We think that matter is just a bunch of stuff. So if there's going to be this trajectory, this intelligence, it has to be somehow provided from the outside, either right. by humans or by God.
Right.
So we think in the story of separation, we think that matter's just matter, protons, neutrons, and electrons, but God comes along and imposes design onto matter,
right.
the intelligent designer.
Yeah.
And that, it sure seemed that way scientifically until systems theory came along half a century ago and started to say, whoa, hold on here. Order is inherent in matter. Nonlinear dynamic systems spontaneously develop organization without anybody planning it out, without anybody deciding, without an artist. Beauty emerges without an artist. Structure emerges without an architect. And that is the seed of a different intuition that doesn't require an external divinity, but basically is reaching an esoteric religious tradition said the same thing. God is everywhere in everything, not a separate being from matter, but part of matter. Everything is God. So I would say that my view would be more like that.
So the beauty that arises, you know, like from, for example, your creativity in your writing, do you see that as a part of that process?
You know, I'm doing what life does when life is in the position that it is in. So I guess everything's part of that process.
Right, right. Thanks so much for your time, and your answers were absolutely fantastic. I really appreciate it. And really appreciate you giving us the opportunity to have a chat.
Well, thanks for that. I appreciate your questions as well and the quality of your listening. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks for listening to The New Common Sense. We're at meditation.org.au, and don't forget to install our latest free app, Love Meditation, on Android.